Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Talking Tudors. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'd like to begin by acknowledging and thanking the generous listeners who continue to support Talking Tudors on Patreon, and extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review the show. As an independent podcaster, this really does mean a lot to me. If you love the podcast, if you never miss an episode, I invite you to join the Talking Tudors Patreon community. Please visit patreon.com/talkingtudors for more information. When you join the patron family, you'll instantly unlock access to exclusive posts, including audio releases and videos. Patrons are also eligible to attend additional monthly live talks and take part in a member-only book club. They can also enter patron-only monthly giveaways, to name but a few of the perks. You can also support the podcast and share your love of Tudor history with the world by buying Talking Tudors merchandise. Check out all the products at talkingtudors.threadless.com. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the podcast to chat about the life of Alice Spencer is Vanessa Wilkie. Vanessa is the William A. Moffat Senior Curator of Medieval Manuscripts and British History at the Huntingdon Library, Art Museum and Botanical Gardens. She has a PhD in British History and Gender History and an MA in Public History from the University of California, Riverside. She lives in Los Angeles. A Woman of Influence is her first book. Let's dive straight into our conversation. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Vanessa. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you, Natalie?
Yeah, I'm doing okay, thank you. I'm so looking forward to chatting with you today about a really exciting subject. So before we dive in, though, can you just say hello to everyone and just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about you and your background?
Yeah, hello, everyone. I am a British historian. I have a PhD in gender history and women's history in early modern English history, so 16th and 17th century, from UC Riverside. And I was a professor for a couple of years. And then for the last decade, I've been a curator of medieval manuscripts in British history at the Huntington Library, just outside of Los Angeles.
Oh, how wonderful. That sounds brilliant. And we are actually here to talk about your latest book, which is Woman of Influence, The Spectacular Rise of Alice Spencer. So do you want to tell us a little bit about when you first became interested in the life of Alice Spencer?
Yeah, I met Alice early on in my PhD program. I met her through her daughter, her oldest daughter, Anne, who was the Countess of Castlehaven. And I was writing a paper for a class about these horrible Castlehaven trials that I'm sure we'll talk about. But the more I started looking at the trials, the more I started to realize that something was happening behind the scenes, like outside of the courtroom, that was influencing what was going on. And I wanted to better understand what that was. And that's how I started to kind of look at the broader world around Anne and understand where she came from, who were her parents. And that's how I met Alice. And then I started working backward from there to understand how did these women know how to navigate this legal system? So I just started going all the way back to the beginning. Alice was born at Althorp in 1560. And so I just decided that's where I needed to start to work my way up to understanding what was happening in the 1630s.
It's funny how often that happens, where you start at one point, but then you realize that you need all that kind of contextual and background information. So you end up going backwards as well. So there may be people listening that actually haven't heard of Alice Spencer. So would you like to tell us a little bit about her family and her early life as well?
Her parents were basically local knights. And they owned Althorp was their home. Her grandfather had built, I think it was her grandfather who built Althorp, which of course today is quite famous as the home to Earl Spencer and the childhood home to Princess Diana and the burial place of Princess Diana. But Alice's Althorp was not what visitors at Althorp today would see. It was more of a manor home with lots and lots of sheep pastures all around, which is similar, I suppose, to what you would see today. Her family was just starting to amass some local influence and power. And really, they were her parents. Her father was growing this massive sheep farm. They became kind of the leading providers of wool and mutton in England in the middle of the 16th century. Her father was a knight. And she had quite a large family of lots of brothers and sisters. Some of her sisters, we don't know who they were, that we don't know what their names were. They're kind of lost in the historical record. Her older sisters, we can trace their marriages, and that's how we mostly know who they are. She had a very typical background or upbringing where she was taught to read, she was taught to sew. She was taught the arts and music and things like that, probably. And then really we learn more about her once it's her turn on the marriage market. And that's where her family, by this point, they had a lot of capital wealth, but not a lot of aristocratic influence. They didn't have a title. So they started to use some of their capital wealth to kind of, it sounds kind of cynical, but kind of buy their way in to the aristocracy, which is what a lot of families were doing at that time with their daughters. So Alice helped them make this just enormous leap into the aristocracy by marrying Ferdinando Stanley, the heir to the Earldom of Derby. And they were married in like 1579-ish. And that's when we really start to learn about Alice. That's where we see her a lot more. And that's where we really start to see her learning how to be this very influential woman that she became.
And so you've mentioned, obviously, she marries well into this family. So, and they have several daughters. Is that right? Her and Ferdinando?
Yeah, she and Ferdinando have three daughters. Anne is the eldest, and then Frances, and then Elizabeth.
Everyone's got the same names in this period.
I know. It's really a nightmare as a researcher.
And so this is the time where, as you've mentioned, you know, we get to know her a little bit better and we see her, of course, becoming quite a patron of artists as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that chapter of her life?
Yeah. So Ferdinando was already quite he was kind of coming into his own as a Renaissance man. Of course, we can look back at it today and recognize that this is the English Renaissance in the 1580s, 1590s, but when they were doing it, it just was what you were supposed to do. They didn't have that word, Renaissance. Ferdinando was patronizing tumblers, I think like acrobats, who would perform it in their estates up in the north, or they would travel around and they'd perform for Queen Elizabeth at court. And so Alice started to kind of learn that courtly life as a wife, you know, to prepare her to become the Countess of Derby someday. And so Ferdinando was a writer too. He wrote a little bit. And then as the playing troupe started to evolve in the late 1580s, 1590s, Ferdinando had his own group of players. Were called his title as a baron was called Lord Strange. So he had a group of players called Lord Strange's Men. And they wrote plays and performed and traveled all around. And William Shakespeare was one of the players early on who was part of that troupe. So Alice and Ferdinando were just rubbing elbows with all of these, you know, people that of course go on to become canonical. But from Alice's vantage point, Shakespeare was just this guy that was kind of in and out of their house, writing plays and hanging out with her husband. And she seemed throughout her life to really revel in the arts and in the theatrical productions and masque performances of the 16th and 17th century. They were forms of entertainment, but also kind of ways to show that you were in the know and that you were dialed into cultural production and performance at the time.
Yeah, that is an exciting connection, isn't it? But funny how Yes, of Course doesn't know how famous he's going to become.
Right.
Now, of course, Vanessa, this would not be Tudor history if there wasn't some sort of scandal and mysterious death happening. So tell us a little bit about the Hesketh plot and also Ferdinando's mysterious death.
Oh gosh, yeah, it's like you can't make this stuff up. There's no
No.
reason to make this stuff up because the records just are shocking as you're reading them. So the Stanley family, they kind of ruled the North. And in fact, they had a lot more autonomy than a lot of other families at this period. And Ferdinando, it seems, my read on the sources are that he really was a good Protestant to Queen Elizabeth. But of course, this wasn't just the Renaissance, it was the Reformation happening in England at this time, happening all over Europe at this time. So Ferdinando's relatives and ancestors were much more friendly to Catholics than Queen Elizabeth would have liked, I think. So it gave this impression for a lot of Catholics who were on the European continent that they couldn't quite tell if Ferdinando would be friendly to Catholics or if he would, how devout his Protestantism was. So there was a Jesuit who lived in the community, and his brother had been traveling all the way to Prague, I think, across throughout the Reformation. And they ended up shortly after Ferdinando inherited the title of the Earl of Derby, and Alice is the Countess of Derby now. They show up at their estate one day, and they kind of make an agreement to Ferdinando and say, "Look, we're local guys. We know you. Do you want to come talk with us a little bit more?" So he makes an appointment to meet with them like a few days later, a week later. And when he meets with them one on one, they make this offer to him that if he is promises to be friendly to Catholics, they will help him overthrow his cousin, Queen Elizabeth. They will put him on the throne, and then he will be king, and he has to open up England to Catholics, which is a terrible idea for him to do. Meeting with these people, it turns out, I mean, he didn't know what the meeting was going to be about, but being part of this conversation would be treasonous. So he ends up escorting the Hesketh brothers to London. He sends a letter to the court saying, "I have this horrible meeting. I'm going to bring these guys to you. I want nothing to do with this." He turns the plotters in, and they're arrested in London, and they are tortured and executed. They confess to everything, and they're executed. So it's a really terrifying time for Ferdinando and Alice because they just want to make sure that they're in good graces with Queen Elizabeth, and they want to prove their loyalty to her, and they don't want anything to do with these Catholic plotters. And they're worried about their three little girls and the future of their family. So of course, Ferdinando has to continuously prove to Queen Elizabeth that he's not trying to steal her throne. He will be a good and dutiful subject. And then he returns to the North. And a few months after this plot, he suddenly takes ill one day, just out of the blue. And he is convinced it's a very, like, he kind of starts to lose his mind a little bit during this fever and illness. And he is convinced that he has been poisoned. And kind of the household starts to think it might have been poisoning by, people seeking revenge for having turned in these plotters. And he ends up going through this very arduous treatment to try and, he's bled, he's given these plasters all over his body, he's given all these serums to drink, and ultimately he dies of whatever his illness was. He thinks it was witchcraft. Actually, he thinks he was cursed by, I should say, not poisoned. He thinks he was cursed for turning in these plotters. But in the end, it kind of doesn't matter. He died, and then poor Alice was left to try and figure out what to do. She had only been a countess for a few months. She had three young daughters. Her husband had been implicated in this plot one way or another, and then he just dies very brutally and suddenly. So she just has to figure out where to go from there.
Goodness, what a story. You could just do a sort of whole movie just on that part, couldn't you? That's
Right.
so dramatic. And of course, like so many women left in Alice's position, it's a very vulnerable position to be in. And she does, in fact, have many sort of legal battles and challenges that she faces after his death. So talk to us a little bit about that time in her life.
Yeah, so Ferdinando from his deathbed actually dictates a will And in his will, he leaves most everything. It's a period of transition. Alice was actually pregnant at the time of his death, kind of makes these accommodations to say, if you have a son, then he's my heir, and everything goes kind of en masse to him. And if you don't have a son, then you will, he wants Alice to kind of maintain control of most of his properties. And then he wants it to pass to his eldest daughter, Anne, and kind of makes all of these arrangements for the what if, what if, what if situation, because his daughters aren't very old at the time. And of course, that means then that essentially Ferdinando has a younger brother, William, who inherits the earldom. He becomes the sixth Earl of Derby. But William is irate that this will is basically leaving all of the property to these women, and that he thinks inheriting the title means he should be inheriting all of the land too. So Alice and William kind of embark on this 13-year massive legal showdown where Alice just starts taking claim to anything she possibly can, and William is trying to outmaneuver her. So
Goodness, it's a familiar story. It happens quite regularly, doesn't it? With heiresses, especially, obviously, with all this great land and wealth.
Decades ago, historians did a lot of research on this period and started to argue, and I think they're quite right, that there's a little bit of a demographical crisis in England, that more girls are being born than boys. And so it's throwing the traditional kind of primogeniture system into crisis, because the common law system of inheritance isn't working when there's families like Alice's, where there are so many girls and no boys.
So, speaking of the girls, tell us a little bit about Alice's relationship with her daughters. What do we know about that?
Oh my gosh, it's really fascinating because the records allow us to understand that she had such different relationships with each of her daughters. And that was actually, as I got deeper into the research, that was something that I became quite fascinated by, and something that I thought allowed Alice, it allowed me as a historian to use Alice to help understand more complex ways of, like, aspects of women's lives. Being a mother wasn't just a single fixed category, that she could have these very different relationships and expectations for each of her daughters. So she does these strange maneuverings. She, throughout her lawsuit, as it kind of drags on for a while, she wants to stay single, because as a widow, she had a lot more control over her property than she would as a married woman. So she waits until a very strategic moment in the lawsuit to get married, remarried. And she ends up marrying the man who's kind of the acting Lord Chancellor of England, so the head of the Equitable Court. So she marries her lawyer, basically.
Good move,
It's a
Alice.
really, really good move. And part of the agreements that they have is that, as her lawsuit, her inheritance suit progresses, he'll continue to put lands and money into jointures for her to protect her as a trust. So it's money and lands that she will ultimately control, that he can't just spend and, do with as he wishes. But to sweeten the deal, she actually marries her middle daughter, Frances, to his son, John. So these step siblings become husband and wife. And it really just solidifies and incentivizes her second husband to just go hard after William to get as much land and money as possible, because it's not just building for himself. It's building for his son and his future grandchildren. So it's like the ultimate expression of kind of trying to keep it all in the family. So because they are so closely related, Alice is very close to her middle daughter, Frances. She spends a lot of time with her over. They live in the same household. We see them not writing letters to one another, but we see them through account books, like that they're, decorating houses together and buying fabric for clothes and things like that together. With her youngest daughter, Elizabeth, she quickly then arranges a marriage to Henry Hastings, who is the heir to the earldom of Huntingdon. So Elizabeth, the youngest, kind of goes off to Leicester and sets up, her own great estates, becoming the Countess of Huntingdon and having children. And they correspond. She corresponds a lot with her mother and travels to London and sees her mom a lot and sends her children to be raised in her mother's household. Elizabeth is also a lover of poetry and a patron of the arts. So there's a lot of books dedicated to her in the 17th century. And to her husband, she's quite shrewd as well. Like her mother, she engages in her own lawsuits when she feels like people have wronged her. So they have a you can see that Alice really influenced the way that she handles her family business, the way that Elizabeth handles her family business. Things with Anne, the eldest daughter, is a little bit more precarious. Anne is the third daughter to marry. She marries a man called Grey Bridges, Lord Chandos, and they have several children. And Chandos is a beloved poet and writer, and kind of keeps, he's called the King of the Cotswolds, and he keeps kind of a grand estate of his own. But Anne is very difficult to find in the historical record. There's just not a lot of accounts from her. There's not a lot of correspondence from her. So it's, she's a little bit of a silence in the archive compared to her sisters, who leave a lot of records and documents.
Yeah, the Chandos family. I think that's Sudeley Castle, isn't it? As well.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, it's so stunning. I love, oh, it's one of my favorites. That's why it popped into my head. So Alice definitely sounds like a shrewd political operator. Is that the sense you got from your work as well?
Absolutely. It's strange because in hindsight and looking at thinking about Alice as a person, not just a person on the page, but like a fully corporeal being. She's really good at her job as an aristocratic mother. She takes it very, very seriously. It is her greatest contribution. It's what she saw as her greatest responsibility. Everything she did was to elevate and create opportunities for her daughters and her grandchildren and for her Spencer siblings and her nieces and nephews. She's really close to Robert Spencer, who inherits the Spencer title or the estates, her nephew. He inherits Althorpe when her brother dies. So she's really close to him. So she really plays this patroness, not just in the theatrical arts, but she's a patroness to all of the people in her life who are, you know, trying to rise socially and politically. But in doing that, she is not a very loving person. She's pretty calculating. She's really harsh with her daughters and with her sons-in-law in particular. She'll tell them, I expect you to do this. Why aren't you going to court? Why aren't you saying this? Why aren't you fighting this fight? Why are you letting this happen? So she does not keep her opinions to herself, but she also, like, everything, it's kind of icky because everything she says sounds so mean and harsh, but she's not wrong. But she just has this really brutal, formidable way about her.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So does she have an actual official position at Elizabeth's court, or is that just her husband's role?
No, it's just her husband. So her husband, her second husband, is a man called Thomas Egerton. And he is Queen Elizabeth's Lord Keeper of the Great Seal. He's a member of the Privy Council. And then in 1603, when Queen Elizabeth dies and King James VI of Scotland, the first of England, ascends to the throne, he promotes Egerton to becoming Lord Chancellor, and he gets a title of Baron Ellesmere. So, but, you know, Alice continues to use the title Dowager Countess of Derby through her entire life. So she outranks her husband in that regard, and she doesn't let him forget that.
Another clever move. Very good.
Very clever. Yeah.
And of course, being the fact that Thomas is at court with Elizabeth means that, you know, sometimes they get visits from the Queen. And this does, in fact, happen to Alice and Thomas. So tell us a little bit about that visit to Harefield Place.
Yeah. So Alice and Thomas get a house called Harefield that's in Middlesex. So it's not terribly far from London. Today, it's all kind of part of the greater metropolitan area. But in the 17th century, in the beginning of the 17th century, it was a bit of a journey away. So on one of Queen Elizabeth's summer progresses in 1602, Harefield is one of the stops that she makes. And it is ridiculous, the extravagance of this visit. So Alice and Thomas and the people that work at their estates, they do all of these preparations. It's just feast after feast. I mean, you just picture like early Game of Thrones episodes before it gets awful. I mean, you know, gruesome. It's sort of like that. It's just such a grand spectacle. They hire different playwrights to turn the entire village of Harefield into a performance. So when Queen Elizabeth's wagons are coming along the road, they're actually met by characters in costume that sort of begin the grand entertainment before she even reaches Harefield, and then it just continues. So they really just blend fantasy and reality for all of the days that the court is there. And of course, it rains almost the entire visit. So they kind of rewrite some of the plays to accommodate the dreary weather, and they do all kinds of things with rainbows, and it's such a just such a spectacle. They spend an exorbitant amount of money on these performances. But they also, you know, this being court politics, they have other reasons for wanting to do this too. So Alice wants to get Queen Elizabeth's blessing to have Francis marry John, even though it's sort of already been settled that they were going to. They kind of jumped the gun a little bit on that. So during the entertainments, at one point, Alice, you know, approaches the queen and kind of says that she hopes to get her blessing, and maybe Francis can work in Elizabeth's court. And the queen is really quick to dismiss her and kind of says, "I know that this is all a charade, and I know that you're asking me, and it's too late. So I don't appreciate this." And it really, it's one of the only times in the historical record that we really see Alice kind of on her back foot a little bit and just kind of thrown for not totally in control of what's happening, because she's messed up. And then she just, you know, puts on a good face, and the performances continue. And all accounts, of course, there's a bunch of letters because everyone's gossipy about, oh, you know, the queen kind of came down on Alice. But then all of the letters kind of say that by the end of the visit, Alice has rebounded, all of the fences have been mended, everything is fine. But it's just such a cringy, awkward moment to picture Alice in her own home being so dismissed by the queen.
Goodness, and we know Elizabeth just didn't like not knowing things that were going on with her courtiers, so you can
No,
just imagine how cranky she would have been.
such a horrible misstep. Alice definitely knew better. So, and I
Yeah.
kind of like those moments too where she messes up. It doesn't happen
Yeah.
very often. And so it's a good reminder that she, you know, was human and kind of overplayed her hands sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just love to have witnessed one of those incredible progresses. I'm obsessed with royal progresses, and I think the Elizabethan ones in particular were just these
Yeah.
huge shows, weren't they?
Yep, they went on for months from place to place to place. And it's
Absolutely.
half theater, half feast, half dancing, half music, just the exchange of gifts.
Yes,
Yep.
and could bankrupt you. Like several people were bankrupted from attempting to host the Queen.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's some really great letters that I've seen of later, when the Stuarts are on the throne, of family of members of like the Cecil's writing to Thomas Egerton saying, "Hey, can I borrow your silver? The king's coming to dinner." Like they realize it's just cheaper to try and loan nice things to each other than to have all
Yeah.
of these, you know, kind of the quote unquote great families go bankrupt trying to host each other and outdo each other. So I love those letters where people are writing saying, "The king is on his way. Can I borrow your silver?"
I love that. Love it. Now, tell us a little bit about the scandal that later engulfs this family.
Yeah, so this is really quite horrific. But so Anne marries Anne's husband, Grey Bridges. Lord Chandos dies. He dies from drinking bad spa water. He's sick and he goes to the continent to try and, you know, take baths to heal
Yeah.
in the mineral-rich waters. And allegedly he got some of the water in his mouth and drank it, and it's, you know, what we would now know is bacterial ridden, and he died during this treatment. And so Anne is a widow for a little while, but she gets remarried to a much younger man called the Earl of Castlehaven. And he is English, but his title is Irish, and his family is not, they have a terrible reputation, just to put it plainly. So Alice is very upset by this marriage. Of course, it's her daughter's second marriage. She doesn't need her mother's consent.
No.
She has children. She's, you know, she's done all the right things prior to this. And so she marries this man that everybody is really shocked that she has married him, in part because he has this Catholic or this Irish title. And I wouldn't say he was a terribly religious man, but if he did have a religious, like a confessional identity, it would have been Catholic probably. So he didn't seem very discreet about that. His brother was just a raging Catholic. His sister was a woman called Eleanor Davies Douglas, who was prophesizing at court about King Charles's death. She was publishing all of these wild prophecies. She went to the Lichfield Cathedral once and broke in and poured tar all over the altar in protest. And then she was arrested and put into Bedlam Hospital slash prison for a while. So she just was a real problem, a personality problem.
No.
Actually, Alice had encounters with her earlier too. Elizabeth, her youngest daughter, was heir was married to Lady Eleanor's daughter, and she never paid the marriage portion. And so the family had already sued her once to, and they won to get the marriage contract paid out. So Alice just had a bad run-in with this family in the past, and now her daughter was married to, you know, the Earl of Castlehaven, and pretty quickly then married, like her mother, she married her daughter to Castlehaven's heir. So step siblings again get remarried, and that was a problematic match. They were really young. They were just young children. And now they're living in the same house and Alice doesn't like it. And so things in that estate, the estate is called Font Hill Gifford. It's really just a dangerous, treacherous place. The Earl of Castlehaven starts sexually abusing his daughter-in-law slash stepdaughter. And then ultimately he entices one of his servants to sexually assault his wife. And he participates in that. So there's a whole big, long story about how this ultimately comes to light. The Countess of Castlehaven didn't tell anyone. She didn't want people to know about this. But the Privy Council gets called in because they think that the Earl of Castlehaven is mismanaging the finances of the estate. So they come in thinking they're looking at a money situation, and then they uncover this just home of abuse. And they break up the household and they arrest the Earl. And then in interviewing people, there are accusations that the Earl is engaging in acts of sodomy with his male servants. So they end up charging the Earl with both rape and sodomy. And they charge one of the male servants with rape, and they charge another male servant with sodomy. And so they take testimonies over and over again from the women in the household. And it just is, it's something that had never, this trial like this had never happened before. So the King Charles is on the throne at this point, Charles I. And he, because the Earl is a member of the peerage, he appoints a special counsel so that the outcome of the trial doesn't impact anything legally. It's just a trial about the Earl and his actions. And Anne's testimony is read on her behalf. She doesn't appear in the trial. No woman is allowed to appear in person in the trial. In fact, King Charles issues a proclamation basically banning any women from attending the trial because even hearing conversation like this would ruin somebody's reputation, a woman's reputation. So the courtroom is a completely male space. And ultimately, the Earl is found guilty of both rape and sodomy. And then he is executed. And then after the execution, the servants stand trial. So it kind of, you know, it's, you sort of know how it's going to go The Earl has already been executed. But fascinatingly, Anne appears in person at their trial. And she gives the testimony in person, basically not going into a lot of graphic detail, but saying everything that I've already said is true. Everything that was read at the other trial is true. And then in the court transcripts, it describes that she asks the judges if she is allowed to look directly at the defendants. And she looks at them in front of everyone. And then she just gets up and departs to go into her carriage as quickly as possible. And they are each found guilty of their charges and both executed as well. And then Alice swings into action and starts petitioning the king and members of the council to secure as much land and favor and money as she possibly can for her daughter and her granddaughter. She sets up funds to make sure that they're financially cared for, although she also says some pretty brutal and, you know, chastising things to each of them, basically victim shaming them and saying that it's their fault that they were in those positions and how could they possibly have allowed this to happen. I'm paraphrasing there a little bit, but not very much. So she, you know, is really, it's an example of Alice quite true to form, where she wants to do all she can to maintain status and wealth and, you know, secure some stability for them, but also she separates them from the rest of the family and kind of isolates them, and she doesn't want anything that they have done or their, she calls it their wicked ways, to impact the rest of the family.
Goodness, that must have been so difficult for her daughter and granddaughter.
Yeah, Alice is determined that her granddaughter should go back to be married to, you know, go back and live with her husband. which her husband refuses to accept her in the house. So Alice loses that one. She doesn't ever go back. It's hard to know what exactly happens to her granddaughter, but she doesn't go back to live peacefully with her husband.
No.
But she does set up, she builds a manor house and she sets up Anne. She lives a couple villages away from her. She gives her an annual allowance, and in her will make sure that Anne's taken care of for the rest of her life too. But with the
Yeah.
expectation that she's never going to marry again, and she just needs to live a quiet life away from everything else,
She
which
does
it
sound
seems
like a
she
very
does.
complex woman, doesn't she? Did you find that
Yeah.
those sort of contradictions between helping and then chastising and all that difficult to kind of deal with?
At first I did, but it actually, in a way, she's so consistent. She's so weirdly consistent as a
Yeah.
person throughout the. She lives to be 77 years old, which is, a remarkable time span. And as a historian, to have a central subject who lives for such a long
Yes.
time that you can follow for such a long time, she's so consistent in her behavior and the choices. So after a while, when I started to read things, I would just think, like, yep, that sounds like Alice. Like, that's just Alice being Alice. So I think it made it possible to understand her motivations a little bit better than it sometimes is for other women in the past, because there are so many holes and gaps in the archival record where you don't really know, and you end up just having to wildly speculate about what happens or why it happens. Alice is pretty, I won't say it's easy, but it's much more possible to trace the arc of Alice's life because she's so well documented and because she's so consistent with her desires.
And so tell us a little bit about the final months of Alice's life and what you think her legacy is.
Yeah, so she after the Castlehaven trials, Alice does what Alice does, and she has a giant party, and she hires John Milton to, I mean, John Milton was not the Paradise Lost John Milton quite yet. He was a clerk for her son-in-law and worked in their household. So she hires him to write the entertainment, or the family hires him to write this entertainment. So he writes arcades for her after the Castlehaven trials. And then a couple of years later, her son-in-law, who is also her stepson, becomes the president of the Marches of Wales. So he basically is the king's representative in Wales. And they hire Milton again to write a masque to mark that celebration. And that's Comus. That becomes it's originally called the Masque at Ludlow Castle, because that's the castle that they live in. But he penned Comus for them, and it's Alice's grandchildren that first perform Comus. It's their music teacher who plays the role. So, Alice, that's towards the end of her life, and she is, sitting in this castle in the Marches of Wales as her family has elevated and taken on more and more political responsibility, and she's watching her grandchildren perform Milton for them. So it's hard. I mean, obviously there's no record where Alice talks about her feelings about this, but it's pretty easy to imagine, to use that moment to think back about, in the 1580s, Alice and Ferdinando watching, Lord Strange's men perform, and then fast forward to the 1630s, and she's watching her grandchildren perform with Milton. It makes sense, I guess. When she dies, she's 77 years old, and she, so shortly after, two of her daughters predecease her, Frances and Elizabeth, both die a couple of years before she does. So it's just Anne and her grandchildren left. But before she dies, she commissions a tomb to be erected in the church in Harefield, and it is still there to this day. It is gigantic and just dripping with heraldry, and it's all about how the Spencers and the Stanleys are, on equal footing, at that in her eyes at that time, and how she elevated all of these people. And there's little statues of her daughters, her three daughters, underneath, kind of holding up the tomb. So it's really quite something. It's very Alice. But in she writes a very long will where she is quite particular about who gets what, and she leaves a lot to charity. She writes about what kind of funeral she wants. She makes arrangements for who she wants her grandchildren to marry in some cases. So she's, as thorough in death as she was in life.
Amazing, and amazing that you mentioned Ludlow, another one of my favorite places, but I've never thought of Alice Spencer when I've been there, so now I will next time
Yeah.
I visit. Well, you know, the title of your book, you've got The Spectacular Rise, and this really is a spectacular rise, isn't it? It's just quite a story, and it's strange that it's not more well known. Now you've brought it, of course, to the light, but it is an extraordinary story, isn't it?
It's extraordinary about how well documented she is. I think one of the things I've really come to appreciate about my time with Alice is, I mean, I think that she was a powerhouse. I think she understood, she showed just resolve and self-discipline, but also a lot of cruelty to the people in her life. But since you can kind of plot so much of her rise and the decisions and the options that she had and where she made choices and why she chose one thing over another, it makes it possible to then kind of map that onto other women from the period who aren't as well documented. And I think Alice is really, I mean, I'm personally enthralled and fascinated by her story and her life. But as a historian, the thing that I value the most about her is actually what her life allows me to understand about what was possible for other women in that period, to the women that we just don't get to know as much about.
Oh, that's actually an excellent segue into the final question that I had for you, Vanessa, which is, what insights do you think we can actually glean from Alice's story about women and power in the 16th and 17th centuries?
Yeah, that's the ultimate question. I think that Alice really shows us that for women of a certain class and a certain race and religious identity in England, it was possible to really have a lot more autonomy. I mean, Alice would never have thought of herself as an individual. She would always believe that anything she was doing for her entire family as a unit. You know, she thought in terms of dynasty, not in terms of individual. So she would, her tomb tells us, because it's got loads of Spencer heraldry all over it, kind of in some pinnacles, some important positions. It's the Spencer heraldry, not the Stanley heraldry that she's highlighting. So Alice helps us really think about the connections that women had throughout their lives to their natal families, not just to their married families, you know, because women's names changed when they were married and because they completely lost through common law, under coverture, they lost any legal autonomy as a wife. It's easy to lose track of women in the period because they just get absorbed into their husband's family. But Alice helps us because she holds on to her Spencer identity throughout her. I mean, she's very, very proud to be a Stanley. She's very, very proud to be the Countess of Derby throughout her life. And she's proud to be, you know, married to the Lord Chancellor. They didn't have a great marriage, but, you know, it's a useful marriage for her. But she really keeps that Spencer and Stanley bloodline and family line in her mind, they're equal. And so I think it allows us to think about women's loyalty, aristocratic women's loyalty to their natal families in a way that we don't often get to think about. And, you know, her legal prowess is remarkable. She starts to learn, and I'm sure this is not a natural gift. I'm certain there are men in her life, probably her Spencer brothers, who are helping her do this. And certainly Thomas Egerton, who becomes her second husband, helps her do this a lot. But she really develops a legal strategy that she is very much a part of. There's no question that she's relying on men to do a lot of things, but she really is a key player in developing that strategy. She's part of the legal team, I guess, is a way to think about it. And so I think it's a really important, we sometimes think that legal agency for women happens, like it's a progress narrative. Like back in the olden days, women didn't have any authority, yes. But over time they got more and more. But Alice helps us complicate that and understand that throughout time, women and, you know, people who are marginalized within the law, who shouldn't have any rights, actually do have agency if they have allies and you know, prowess.
Yeah.
So she helps us complicate not just an understanding of how the law worked for women, but she helps us complicate an understanding of how it worked for men too.
Yes, reminds me a lot of obviously the three-decade legal battle that Anne Clifford fought as well around the same time. Yeah. They were contemporaries, weren't they? So so interesting. So many things to think about. But I think you're right. That seems to be that you still need those male allies to assist you. Absolutely. At that point, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, poor Anne Clifford. I thought about her so much when I was researching Alice, because she's such a famous, you know, kind of the touchstone in the the model for where things inheritance suits go so horribly wrong for women time and time again. And she makes these marriages that are just disastrous after, you know. So where it's, I mean, this is overly simplifying things, but where Anne Clifford seems to do everything wrong, Alice seems to do everything right. And I don't think it's as simple as just these two women. There's so many people around them that make that work for or against them. But, you know, Alice is really a kind of a nice anchor point to help complicate our understanding of women and inheritance, because for so long, it's only been Anne Clifford that we've really known about.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And I highly recommend to anyone that's listening and wants to know more about this extraordinary yet complex woman to, of course, go and have a look at your book, buy a copy of your book, which is wonderful. And there's one last thing that I will ask you, Vanessa, and that's for a Tudor takeaway, or it might be a 17th century takeaway. So something for our listeners to go off and explore after the episode.
I would be remiss not to say, if you haven't explored the National Archives paleography tools, you should have some fun with that. The Folger Shakespeare Library also has some fantastic online paleography tools to allow you to learn how to read secretary hand, which is the common court hand that most of these documents and records are written in. They don't use exactly the same alphabet that we use today. Their handwriting is quite different than what we use today. The letters are connected, so it's related to cursive, but the letter shapes are totally different. So having some fun with online paleography tools is a great Tudor takeaway. And it just, when you can read the sources for yourself, you know, through digital libraries like the Huntington's Digital Library or the Folger or the British Library, you know, which is down right now, but they're fighting the good fight and they're going to come back strong. You know, once you can get access to those sources again, to be able to read the original documents or the digitized versions of those documents in the original hand is really, it just makes it that much more real and brings you that much closer to your Tudor subjects.
It really does. And what was Alice's handwriting like? Was it okay?
It wasn't great. Most of her letters are actually written, a secretary copied them for her, but she had this really lovely signature. It was very flourishy and it was A. Darby. And
all right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast and talk about this extraordinary woman with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.